welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome, Gladys and Potties, to Classic LNL, and for this Good Friday edition, we're going back to an interview I had in 1996 with Sister Veronica Brady, a writer, a teacher, a cultural theorist, a critic, and last but not least, a nun. She spent the last 40 years reflecting our society right back at us, in many ways being our social conscience. She was a damn good conscience when she was on the ABC board, too, I'm going to tell you. She's a member of the Loreto Order in Perth, and her books include The Future People, The Mystics, Crucible of Prophets, Can These Bones Live, and South of My Days, a biography of Judith Wright. Vronnie was more or less a regular commentator on our program, so I decided for this interview to focus on her as a human being type person.
Now, Veronica, first of all, welcome.
Thank you, Philip, and thanks for indulging me with letting me choose my music and talk to you.
Now, you've written about your parents, but not much about your mother. Your father seems to have been the major influence, and I like the cut of his jib, the way he refused to fight in the First World War and worked as a part-time SP bookie. Why don't you talk about your mother?
I was very, very fond of her, Philip. I don't know, you probably have to ask Sigmund Freud. I always thought when I was an adolescent that it was my mother that I was very close to, and I used to talk a lot to her. But I realised that I've grown up more like my father, having fought with him in the appropriate adolescent sort of fashion. And so now when I reflect back, I want to talk about him because I didn't do him justice when I was an adolescent. I mean, all adolescents are repulsive. And I think I was more than usually repulsive.
Now, write that down, listener. All adolescents are repulsive. That's the aphorism of the week.
Well, you know what I mean, don't they? They're all poor creatures trying to find out who they are and stamping on everybody else's toes.
Pimples and puberty.
Exactly. Yes, I had the lot.
Yeah. Now, why did you decide to become a nun rather than a femme fatale?
Well, of course, I don't have, you talk about cut of the jib, I don't have the necessary equipment to be femme fatale. But not all through my last year or so at school, I had this sneaking feeling, you can only think of it as something like conscience, which said, really, you ought to be a nun. And my sensible mother, who was very sensible when I told her, she was somewhat aghast because my parents were not normal pious Catholics, and said, well, look, go to university first and more or less get that out of your system, which I did, and I still had that funny feeling that it was something that I really ought to do.
But were you a Bolshie nun from the beginning? Because, of course, you grew up during the Depression. You obviously had a sense of social justice kindled in you. Did you always want to be a bit of a rad around the convent?
I didn't want to be a rad, but I was one. You see, I went to university at the most wonderful time, straight after World War II, and it was full of people who'd survived being killed and were thinking about the different sort of world that they might make, and I picked all that up too. I remember I was nearly thrown out from the novitiate when I remarked in the midst of all the fuss over Cardinal Menzensi. Nobody would remember him now, but he was right-wing Catholic, taking shelter in the American embassy, and we're all supposed to be praying for Cardinal Menzensi and those. We were being told how wicked those Russians were who were persecuting the church, and I remarked, innocently enough, because it seemed to me to be the case, that after all the church was in complicity with the great landowners, and that caused great consternation. But I think...
It's a wonder you weren't shown the front door.
Oh, there was talk I might be, but they wouldn't have done it. Now, our order has always been an educated order and a pretty tolerant order, in the spirit of the founding mum who was... a cousin of John Dunn's and a some sort of relation of Thomas More's.
Is that
died
right?
In 1645.
I was going to ask you about that. So she comes.
Oh, yes.
She brings good credentials to.
Oh, she does.
To the profession.
She's got a lovely prose style, and she, when the men were carrying on, and what she wanted to do was found a group of women who'd live the way the Jesuits do. You know, wouldn't be enclosed, wouldn't have to get dressed up in fancy dress, wouldn't be tied down to fixed hours of prayer. And the men began to say, no, this won't do at all. You are but women. And she's got a wonderful writing and says, you will find out that women will do much in the future, and so on. So we've got that tradition, and I think people just, they think, well, that's Veronica, and they put up with me.
Veronica, did you always believe in God from the very beginning?
Philip, I always had this sort of oceanic feeling, if you think. I remember as a kid, we lived in the wheat belt in the country town, I might say, in St. Arnott, where I presume my father was the S.P. bookie. I don't know whether he was, but it's my hunch he was, in order to survive, and we survived quite well. But I was sitting on in a cherry tree, or cherry plum tree. It was a hot summer's day, and I was dangling my feet in the green water of an old rusty tank. And, yes, I got that sort of oceanic feeling, and I used to lie on my back, look up at the stars. So I suppose I've always had that natural proclivity. I've never had much time for or thought about the old gentleman with the white beard.
But OK, I don't want to dwell on this a bit. Hmm. I have the oceanic feeling at the same age. You know, I lay on my back and gazed up at the stars, but I found the universe devoid of meaning. I just didn't get a response from attempts at prayer. You did, and right from the beginning you were calm about this.
I suppose partly it's because I grew up in the Catholic tradition where, in fact, you had all sorts of rituals. You had incense, you had plain chant, you had processions through the convent garden, and also a very long sense of history. My father was interested in history, and he travelled before he married. He had some wonderful art books of things like Chartres Cathedral, and I suppose I sort of felt it was in the family. So I have a sense that there's something there. I call it isness myself. If it isn't there, well, then that's bad luck, because you can't prove it or disprove it. And I think the story of Jesus is a very, very good story indeed. As Chesterton said, it's not Christianity's been tried and found wanting, but found difficult and not tried.
Well, you've mentioned the J word. Let's talk about Jesus before we move on. It seems to me that there are more Jesuses than there are Hamlets.
Oh, yeah.
My favourite, I have to tell you, was the Pasolini one.
Yes.
With slightly crooked teeth and
very grumpy and bad.
Very grumpy and bad-tempered.
Yes.
But infinitely courageous.
Yes.
But almost a secular figure.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons why he was done in. He was not a particularly religious person. I like Bonhoeffer's view of Jesus and of Christianity. You know, Bonhoeffer was the anti-Hitler Protestant who died for his opposition. But Bonhoeffer used to say, look, what we need is we have to stop using these religious words, and we've got to get to the religious thing, and that Jesus was somebody who lived in the centre of life. I also like to think there's plenty of evidence, I think, that when you try to get back and read the documents about him, and of course nobody was there with a notebook, they're just what the community thought he was about, but you can see him sometimes as perhaps not having answers, and that's what I like.
Yes, that's a very attractive thing, isn't it?
Isn't it?
And
you know,
also, his aphorisms are almost as good as yours.
Oh yes, but of course they mightn't be his, they may have been made up. There's a lot of argument amongst the scholars about what he actually did say and didn't
We've done a number of programmes on that. Let's give him the good one-liners, for heaven's sake.
I think, lovely.
I think he deserves those. But you don't like the sentimentalised Christ, do you?
Oh,
the soppy ones?
I find it quite repulsive. You see, when I was an undergraduate, I came across Marx on religion, and I've always taken to heart his words that what many people call God is just a projection of emotional, social, economic, cultural need. I mean, for instance, the great and the good Ronnie Reagan praying before he sent off the US Air Force to zap the unfortunate Iranians, and both sides in wars all praying to God. Now, that can't be God.
Mm. Now, I know that before you signed up, there was a moment when you, this is probably a poor choice of words, flirted with the thought of marriage.
I didn't really flirt with it. The gentleman involved was rather keen, but I must be under sixed or something. I mean, I don't object or anything like that, but I just couldn't think of...
Couldn't get all that excited.
I couldn't really.
You didn't want to close your eyes and think of the Vatican.
Very nice chap, no. So I thought, well, no. Besides which, you see, I thought that I was going to be a great poet. And marriage, I think, would have got in the way there. It certainly would have in the 1950s. I would have kept on having babies until I collapsed, since the man involved was a good Catholic chap. So, no.
I was going to pretend it was Malcolm Fraser or someone like that. But blown the gaff on that one.
Well, Malcolm Fraser, he's too tall and he's too aristocratic. He wouldn't have anything to do with Catholics. One of my gentleman friends as an undergraduate had been to Melbourne Grammar, and he was a bit horrified when he discovered that I was a Mick. So, no, it wouldn't have worked.
Well, I'm glad you've raised that issue about being horrified to discover that one is a Mick, because in these difficult times of rampant bigotry, it's easy to forget how bigoted Australians were against Catholics.
Catholics
against proddies, yeah. But it was only a moment ago that was the social divide.
Oh, when I started school in the country town St Arnold, I had to be escorted by a big girl when I was going to the convent, because we used to pass the government school, the state school we called it. And I gather that we recited more polite rhymes than most.
Well, what was a Catholic dog?
Catholic
stink like frogs jumping off hollow logs.
We'd say Catholics ring the bell while the proddies go to hell. I'm sure they're more cultivated versions, but I've always been a lady, you understand.
But that's all ebbed away, hasn't it? That's all gone, thank the Lord.
Yes, indeed. But we replace it with the things that are just as repulsive. I mean, I've just come back from Brisbane, and I, amongst other things I witnessed, was an unfortunate Asian wandering into a bottle shop on a hot, very hot Brisbane night and innocently asking for an ice cream. Oh, the mockery from this sort of barely human fellow who was there on the counter. You just cringed.
You're listening to Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia via ABC Online and Pod. And this interview with Sister Veronica Brady, Loretto Nunn and Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Western Australia, was first broadcast in 1996.
I want to talk about Joan of Dark later. Let's continue now with your life with the Loretto Order. You're sent overseas, I understand, to Chicago and Toronto.
I taught for a while, you see, because I already had my degree, which meant the most remarkable thing in those days. Although I have to say that three of the nuns who taught me also had degrees, and that was in the late 30s and 40s. Yes, I was rung up one day by a very enlightened superior who asked me if I'd like to go and do my PhD in North America. So I said, yes, that's fine. I did a semester at the University of Chicago, right in the middle of the civil rights movement. There were plenty of black people in Chicago. And in those days, I was in full fancy dress, veil and all of that. So I used to get off the bus and walk through the black quarter, and it was terrific. The kids would come out and say, hi, sister, my name is whatever it is, what's yours? You could see the people. They were collecting food and clothes for the people down south, right in the middle of all the protests. And then, of course, there was the opposition to the Vietnam War, and that was very strong in Canada too. I went on to Toronto. Two of my fellow graduate students were young Americans who'd come up to do graduate work simply to escape the draft. Both of them failed to keep up their marks. Both of them went there, and one I know for sure is now dead. So it brings it home to you.
And when you were brought home, you, for a moment, were tempted to follow another JC, briefly, Jim Cairns, who I had on the program the other day.
Oh, yes, great, great man. Now, in those days, you see, if you wanted to do something like go to a demo, you had to ask the boss. So I asked the boss if I might join in that great Cairns moratorium, to which she said no. She said all the cameras would be on you, which would have been right. And besides, she said, to her eternal shame, we want to get money from the government for our schools. So I subsided. I was a different person then.
Gosh, it doesn't sound like the Veronica Brady we know and love these days.
No.
Veronica, let's punctuate proceedings by playing one of your most beloved pieces of music, or a part thereof. And
thanks.
I think you've chosen Requiem by...
Poray.
Why?
It just seems to me to be heavenly music, and as you get older, I begin to think more, One thing is we all die, and I think this notion of just dissolving where such stuff as dreams are made on is, it's the notion I'd like to live with.
I'm talking to Sister Veronica Brady. Is that how you imagine death might be? An almost ecstatic dissolving?
Well, I don't really imagine it, Philip. It's mine. That's the way I live. I just take things as they come. I think more and more about the fact that the next stop will be to die, and at the moment I don't find it frightening. I think that kind of music says to me that's probably what I hope it will be, but I really don't look ahead. I hope it'll be like that. And either there's something or nothing. I happen to believe there is something, and I think that something then will be ineffable and rich.
Does Veronica Brady survive in this something? In other words, do you live on individually, do you imagine, or is it some sort of dissolving into everything?
I don't know. I probably react against the kind of Catholicism that I was taught as a child, that God knows exactly what you've done all the time and what you've had for breakfast, and there are different areas of heaven, hell and purgatory ruled out for you. That, I'm sure that isn't. The thing is, we just don't know. I do like to read Dante's Paradiso, and indeed the end of the Purgatorio, but there are lots of things that I say, well, I don't know, and why bother about it? Just trust.
Dark nights of the soul. I can't imagine that you haven't had them. I know you've had struggles with the hierarchy from time to time, although you haven't really been censored or jumped on, have you, by the church in Australia?
No, I haven't really had struggles with them. I presume some of them have great problems with me, but I have mostly spent my life in universities. I live in community, but so I haven't had to report to the bosses, and I don't like to think what some of them think of me, but I think there are also some people there who might be happy about it. No, that wouldn't worry me. Struggles of that kind don't worry me, but of course we all have a sense from time to time, is it worth it? Do I believe in it? What's the use? You can get tired, you can get sick. And I get, I think I'm, like many people at the moment, I'm going through a sort of dark night when I look at what's going on around about us, the dismantling of so many of the decent things that we had, like the welfare state, the rising tide of racism, the inability that so many Australians have to own the past. We weren't monsters. Oh, by the way, I've just published a book, which I wrote 8 years ago, about why we are racists. It's called Can These Bones Live? But I think we all have to own our own grief and our own failures, and then hope there's forgiveness. So I feel profoundly depressed at the moment by what I see going on round about me. I'm profoundly depressed because I like to think that most people are fundamentally decent, in which case there's something peculiar about me, or is it just that they're unthinking? I hate to say, and I think this is what's frightened middle Australia, that people like me, whom they regard as loony lefties, seem to be very arrogant and don't understand them. I have to say I don't understand why you could despise Aboriginal people or Asians, or why you could think that it's a great idea to sack people and then deny them the dole, and to feel that the only important thing for a government to do is to balance budgets. But I'm puzzled and I feel sad.
Do you try and see through the anger of someone like Hanson to comprehend the pain that must have generated?
Oh, and fear. Fear. I happen to think, as somebody who spent a whole life as a teacher, that our education system has failed people extraordinarily. I think part of the reason is, if you really want to be successful, you don't waste your time with the humanities, with literature, least of all painting or music, or you don't pay much attention to history either. You just get on with it and do things like maths and sciences. So many people round about us are what I unkindly call educated barbarians. I believe you have to educate people to feel for others and to be aware that there are different ways of looking at the world. And most civilized societies, of course, equip their members with a sense of the past and how things were then, and the sorrows and the failures as well as the achievements. But we don't seem to have done that. And most Australians, I think, are very frightened. Things are changing all round about them. They don't actually know who they are or where they're going.
I concur. I would add to that an observation that Australians, in fact all people, I think, hold mutually exclusive or contradictory views on almost every issue. And it almost depends which button is being pressed by circumstance, political pressure, peer group attitudes, circumstances. In other words, I think that many of the people who are currently saying obnoxious things about Aborigines or Asian immigrants can be quite easily talked out of that if you press the other buttons about the fair go and decency.
Well, do you know, somebody gave me this tip some time ago, and it works wonderfully. If somebody makes an atrociously racist comment, you don't argue with them. What you say is, "I beg your pardon," and they repeat it. And then you say, "I beg your pardon," and they begin to hear themselves. And in every occasion I've done that, they've backed down and looked sheepish. They hadn't realised
how
what
many
they were
"I
saying.
Beg your pardon" did it take, though? Were you standing there for hours?
Oh,
begging
particularly
their pardons?
Somebody like me, who's a well-known ratbag. But it does work, Philip. I think people don't understand. They don't hear themselves. They really like to be popular and be with the crowd.
Hmm.
God help us. I mean, we know what that led to in Hitler's Germany, don't we?
Yes, that's why it astonishes me that anyone would play the racist card in this country at the end of the century when we've killed hundreds of millions of fellow human beings on the most trivial issues of... race
but
or
even
religion.
In practical terms, I happen to be in giving some lectures and going to conferences and things in parts of Asia in 1988, I think it was, when our beloved Prime Minister made his remarks about Asian migration. And I was astonished at the reaction of people then. The view, most educated Asian people do still think of us as racists. They haven't forgotten the White Australia policy. They realise how foolish we are. A funny little nation of about 17 million people, pink people mostly, capering around, surrounded by these millions of people from cultures with a richness that we could barely dream of. Well, we are foolish.
Mm. So you feel fear?
No, funnily enough, I'm not afraid of anything much. I feel sad, and I can't see why anybody would want to invade us. I mean, these days you just invest, and that's
no, I'm talking about a fear about what we see around us within our community.
I feel deep sorrow, and yes, I do feel fear. I feel fear for the future for young people, because it looks to me as though our society is in for a time of social violence. You can't destroy the hopes of a generation. We're going to have a generation of young people without jobs, which mean dignity in our society, and without hope of a job, and they're being blamed for not having jobs. That's going to give rise to some pretty nasty social violence. We've already seen that some young Aboriginal people have had enough, and they're, God help us, it's very foolish if you've got no power to turn violent. But some of them are turning violent, and violence only breeds violence. So I think, yes, there's some nasty times ahead. And, of course, the solution that many of our fellow citizens see to it is increase the number of police and build more prisons, and so it goes.
Yep, Gladys and Poddies, Classic LNL, ABC Radio National. And in this 1996 interview, I'm talking to Sister Veronica Brady, Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Western Australia, a nun with the Loreto Order, and one of my favourite Catholics.
Let's look at another landscape that you occupy, wherein you dwell, and that's the Roman Catholic landscape. I can imagine that when John 23 was bounding around with that immense amiability of his, shaking the church and giving it a good dusting, that you were very excited and exhilarated.
Mm, yes, those were wonderful, wonderful days. Those days of the of Vatican II, I was in Canada at that time, and I remember getting hold of the documents and thinking, wow, this is it. And you see, it wasn't radical in a sense. It was radical in the sense of going back to roots. It was simply going back to what Christianity's always been. And I always unrepentantly say that just because I'm a Roman Catholic doesn't mean that I can also be a Christian. And in my view, I think the Reformation is over. We all have a great deal to learn from one another. I think the Protestant wing of the church has something to learn from the Catholic wing to do with liturgy and so on. And then we have to learn from them the respect for scriptures, intelligence, community. That was wonderful times, but we've fallen on dark times once more.
Well, that's of course what I was hinting at.
Yes, yes.
It must be a very difficult time for someone as feisty and progressive as you to be in the church when the boss is so acrimonious about on progressive theological issues.
Well, of course, the church isn't the officials. The church, I like to define it, is a community of people of faith, hope, and love. And the people I know and love are Christians of that kind or agnostics of that kind. And my view is that if there is a God, and I assume there is, God can look after things, and you go through bad times. One of my favourite books is Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And I think we're going through a similar time. I call it a tin hat time. And I think if you believe in the sorts of values that I think I believe in, then we have to cherish those and keep them alive. I remember years ago, a young man who was at that stage a Catholic priest and isn't anymore, quoted to me from Comrade Mao's Little Red Book, "When the enemy is in a position of power, it is madness to try a frontal attack. So you take to the mountains and do what you believe in." And I think that's the way. Or there's another bit in the Bible, in the Acts of the Apostles, probably apocryphal, but the Sanhedrin has come together and they're discussing what to do about the disciples of Jesus. And one of them, Gamaliel, gets up and says, "Well, look, if it's just a flash in a pan, it will die out. But if it is of God, it will prevail." And that's what I like to say to myself. If it is of God, i.e. of isness, and life rather than death, of generosity rather than narrow prejudice and fear, of intelligence against emotion, then in the long run it will prevail, and it's our business to keep those hopes alive.
Veronica, while the profundity of isness sinks in, I think we'll play another piece of music. Now, this is the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 in C. Why do you love it so much?
Partly because it ran through that wonderful sentimental film Elvira Madigan, with that exquisite scenery and the good sob story. But I love it
sad,
because it's beautiful.
That's sad at the end.
Yes, I know.
I cried.
Oh, yeah. But there's nothing like having a good cry, Philip.
Let's weep together.
Thank you.
quietly fade that out. I'm talking to Veronica Brady on LNL. Veronica, all the great love stories, I think, are essentially tragic. They all seem to end in the way that Elvira Madigan's story ends. Do you feel, in some sense, a sense of loss in your own life? I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about the glories of carnal love and spiritual love of that sort. Does it?
To be perfectly honest, occasionally, yes. I think one of the things about being a celibate is the sense that there's no one other person to whom you matter absolutely. On the other hand, do you see, I am very fortunate, gifted if you like, that I've always had a it's always been pretty strong sense of whatever isness is, of some presence of within my life of this isness, or call it God if you like. So that when I feel a bit down, I think, well, that's all right. I'm living the way I've been destined to live, if you want it that way. And yes, indeed, I am finally loved. And
so you can have a sort of cosmic cuddle.
I do. I know. Yeah, but you see, I'm also lucky because as a child, I was very much loved. I mean, one of my early memories, apart from sitting on my father's knee, is when I'd been a good child, my mother coming in and giving me a cuddle. I think she'd do the same to my sister too. So, I hope I'm not cow-like, but basically, I've grown up in some strange way. I can trust the world and believe that despite the horrors, and I've got a real sense of the horrors, as Julian of Norwich says, in the long run, all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. But to be honest, yes, occasionally I do miss the sense of the things that I have missed out on. And I think that's part of the problem of some celibates, that we're still children because we've missed out on all those joys and pains and so forth.
I think that's also true of married people I know who don't have children, oddly enough. It does, something doesn't progress. I mean, I make this observation with the greatest charity and friendship about Barry Jones. Mm. You know, Barry's never been a dad.
Mm.
And in a way, he has always remained this great, wonderful, ebullient child, you know?
Yes, yes. I think we need people like that.
It's a benefit to Australia. Mm. It's a dreadful loss to a hypothetical Jones child, I think, though.
Yeah, but then the world is always, you know, it's a funny place. I often think about it that if I'd been whatever is in charge of it, I would have done it differently.
Oh, heavens above. What about the sisterhood? Have you found deep friendship within the female community? Or
yes,
is that, in a sense, a bit dodgy? You've got to watch that.
No, I have. One of them is now dead, a wonderful, wonderful woman who spent the last years of her life in a dreadful racist town which shall not be named in the southwest of, or southeast of Western Australia, just living amongst the Aboriginal people there. And another friend who's still alive, who's a very dear friend, a mad and wonderful Irish woman. So, yes, you do find friends. But you see, the funny thing about our life is that you don't choose the people you live with. So you don't always have close friends, but I have many, many other friends who are not part of the community, and I think that's one of the very good things that comes from a life of somebody who's basically unattached. You have more time for friendship.
Are you sometimes narked that the Vatican won't let you be a fully-fledged religious? In other words, you can't conduct the Mass.
Well, I haven't felt myself called in that way. I don't, you know, I'm not much taken by power over other people, which is the way the priesthood works at the moment. So I don't feel called that way, but I feel extremely angry that that the official church can tell God what to do, can also say that women, of course, are not really fully human at all. And if God calls these women to serve in that way, who has the right to stand in the way? I also am scandalised by the sorts of things it says to the other parts of the Christian church who do ordain women. It's saying we're right and you're wrong. It's bad theology and it's bad humanity.
But women get such a dreadful pasting in the Old Testament, and of course in most other religions they're not exactly full partners, are they?
Oh, absolutely, because I think I'm a great believer in the development of doctrine. And you've got, the Bible's a very dangerous book. I hope I don't shock people. And I say this, it's poetry, and you've got to read poetry very, very carefully. And if you take every word literally, you're in trouble. Again, that's part of the reason why I belong to the Catholic branch of the church, because you don't think that the Bible is the only source of authority. You also take it that the faith of the community can help to correct that. But if you note, Jesus was most remarkable in his treatment of women. He did treat them as equals.
And so, not only that, he singled out Mary Magdalene for special attention, which I think is the most powerful symbol.
Absolutely. And you see, the church got a very bad press.
I think I would have liked it. I don't believe in all that religious stuff, but I think he seems quite a nice chap, really.
Oh, indeed. I'm not sure that he I think he was, in one sense, a very honest question. He was faithful to the intuitions that he had, and that seems to me to be what being really religious is. If you think you know all about God, then I doubt if you know what the word is pointing towards.
Yes, but you're the sort of person who recognises that wisdom lies in knowing what you don't know, aren't you?
Exactly. Yes, I remember reading that, I think it was Socrates said that, and I thought, yes, golly, that's right. Mm. And as you go on, the more you think about things, the more you realise that you don't know. See, I suppose it goes back, Philip, to the days when we used to lie on our backs and look up at stars, and you'd realise that, well, really, I don't understand this much. I happen to think that wonder is probably an extraordinarily important thing, and we knock it out of our children pretty rapidly these days.
You're listening to Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and Pod. This interview with former ABC board member Loretto Nunn, I used to think of her as the Flying Nun because of all the trips from Perth, author and academic, originally broadcast in 1996.
Of course, you became a star yourself, and you became increasingly famous / notorious as you engaged in various public barneys and areas of public policy, not the least of which, of course, was your interesting period at the ABC. Why were you dropped? Why was your board membership not renewed?
Well, far be it from me to plumb the minds of the great, but I would think that it was because there were a group of us who had a different view of what the ABC might be, and we weren't going along with one particular view which was being proposed, and that's fair enough.
Who was the chief executive at that time?
It was Geoffrey Whitehead.
Okay, now I'm being mischievous. What should the ABC be?
The ABC, well, for one thing, I've just written to the Minister, Mr. Alston, but he hasn't replied. Our present servants have a very funny habit of not replying to letters that people like me write.
Now, if you write one of the 60 letters that Alston got about the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, you not only get a little response.
Oh, I would have got, yes.
You
yes,
would
have however.
Been congratulated. However, I sent him 6,000 letters about the ABC.
Doesn't seem to
notice
that. No. I think they've decided there's some people are citizens and some are non-citizens. However, you know, these are people who are liberals who are supposed to value the cut and thrust of argument. However, I point out to everybody, the Act says the ABC is part of the broadcasting system of Australia. Therefore, it's the obligation of the ABC to provide what the commercials can't or won't. So just supposing all the rest of the media suddenly became, in a frenzied fashion, even more lefty than the likes of me, then it'd be the obligation of the ABC to present other views.
Absolutely right. I've always agreed with that. Yeah. I used to urge The Age years ago to hire right-wing pundits and columnists because the prevailing view of all the punditry was left liberal. Yes. You've got to keep being pluralist, don't you?
Yes, but our beloved Prime Minister is now telling the ABC, I believe, which seems to me atrocious to think that any politician would tell the ABC what it ought to do on programme matters. And then these, again, are people who call themselves liberals, who should believe in the importance of respecting institutions. However, I believe he's been telling you that you ought to hire some right-wing commentators. Well, you have a few persons who appear on Radio National from time to time, but that is appalling. They're quite enough. The right-wing commentators fill the airwaves. We have one particular and charming and generous-hearted gentleman.
Young Howard.
Yes, young Howard. Yes, to whom our beloved Premier spoke first when he was announced to us that we were going to have the pleasure of voting for him again. Look, the ABC's got to do what other people aren't doing because people have the right and the need to have a whole range of opinions presented to them. I think that's why so many people today are a bit frightened and bemused, because they've only been given one set of views and values, and ones which don't seem to be particularly useful in the kind of world in which we're living at the moment. So the ABC is essential. It's far more essential than any university.
Really?
And they're not much good at the moment.
Oh. Mm. Why are they much good? Do you agree with Pierre Rickmans that they're...
I do indeed. Look, we're all... Departments for their funding depend on how much money they earn or how much they publish. We're wasting so much paper. But you can imagine what an English department can earn in these ways. Look, and as my brother-in-law, who's an academic, said that, Einstein wouldn't have got into the contemporary university, much less become an academic, because he didn't have a PhD. And Socrates certainly wouldn't have got anywhere, because he wouldn't have gone to the meetings, and he would have asked why all the time. Universities exist to be Socratic, but they're not that at the moment. But at least the ABC is. God bless it.
Touch wood. Okay, reveal all about your fascinating friendship with Patrick White.
Oh, well,
you've been romantically linked.
Ah, yes. Well, isn't that lovely? And we didn't fall out in the long run, which was wonderful, because I saw very little of him. No, I wrote my thesis on Patrick White when I was in Toronto. I started, and my supervisor, who's a good American, said, well, you must write to Patrick White. And I said, certainly not. I've got to read his books, and he gets on with his writing. However, I was finally persuaded to do it. And I think my letter must have charmed him, because I more or less said, dear Patrick White, I'm being obliged to write to you. Then he came to see me and I came back to Australia, and this is the nicest story. I think this cemented whatever friendship we had. At that stage I was living at our house in Carabella Street in Kirribilli, just near the Prime Minister. And in those days there used to be lots of people we called poor men, you know, down and outs, who used to come and ask for something to eat. So after the evening meal we'd all run off and cut sandwiches. And then in the morning, between about 9 o'clock and the morning between 9 and 12, if the side door bell rang, you would grasp a parcel of sandwiches and run to that door and hand out a parcel of sandwiches to the poor man. Well, you can guess it. Patrick White rang the side door. So I think that absolutely enchanted him. I got there just after the person with the sandwiches. And he's in his funny old way, he was fascinated by nuns. And
well, he was fascinated by Christianity, wasn't he?
Yes,
increasingly.
He was. And of course, his kind of Christianity, I think, or his kind of belief is my kind of belief. And I just think his books are the most wonderful books. I feel very sad. I used to, at the beginning of a new year, I used to say, I wonder whether we'll have a new novel from Patrick this year. But we don't anymore. But he was always extremely kind to me. And I didn't.
That was
get
not
anything.
My experience of him.
Very few
Patrick.
People had that.
Dislike Patrick, loved the novels, but yes, I was intrigued that you came out so happily. And
I didn't see much of him, and that was one way I think to.
No, but you loved the writing. You were a great.
Oh, indeed, I did. Yes,
a great.
And he was kind enough to like the things that I said, which cheered me up. Though we know that you trust the tailor, not the teller, but it's nice to think that he agreed with it.
Hang on, you're 10. How old are you now, Veronica?
Man doesn't ask how old he is. 67.
67.
Am I? Yes, this is 1996, yes.
Okay, you've got another 25 years before you
get... I hope not.
A bit more. You get the telegram from
not,
the Queen.
Philip.
You're not serious. You want to chuck it in?
Not chuck it in, but I think, look, the going has been good all along the way. I'm still very healthy. The mind is in good trim. But I don't really like the thought of the bits dropping off.
I want you to become an eccentric and crusty old lady.
I'm that already. But I just the thought of, you have to take what it comes, and I don't like looking ahead. But you see, as I say, there's either something or nothing. If there's something, I don't believe in this hell business, and you know, you
no,
I think God. If you do, you
I wouldn't believe in a God who believed in hell, would you?
No, nor would I.
No.
I think you could explain to me like that some people create their own hells. That's probably true. But if there's nothing, well, then I've had a good innings and go while the innings are on. You understand I'm not about to dash off and look for a vial of hemlock. But if I should find myself in an aeroplane which is crashing, but that's a bit selfish. I mean, it'd be all right for me, but the other people won't want to die. But, you know, if suddenly I'm no longer
you
here,
you suddenly
well, that's
find yourself in
me.
A parachute that is torn might be a...
Or, yes. Or by a door which suddenly blows off. But, you see, I usually fly Qantas, and I think they maintain their aircraft quite well. Dear Qantas.
Do you get frequent flyer points for Purgatory as well, I wonder? You won't spend long in Purgatory, will you? Is that still on the books? I'm not quite sure about Purgatory.
I don't know. I mean, poetically, it's wonderful. You know, Dante's Purgatorio is wonderful. I suppose if you think about it, I don't think of it because I think whatever's the other side, if there is something the other side, is something we don't understand. But you could explain it as, you know, if you're a bit stiff, then you find it rather hard to stretch and run. And I think the general theory of it is your joy is in proportion to your ability to live joyously and your love in proportion to your ability to love. So I suppose purgatory...
Well, you don't find any difficulty in loving, do you? You love universally, oceanically.
Oh, no. There's some things I find it extraordinary. Some people I find it extraordinarily difficult to love. In fact, I have to say, well, I probably don't love them. I certainly don't like them.
You can love people you don't like, can't you?
They say so in theory. I try to keep away from them because I'm not particularly virtuous. But I love existence and I
Isn't
think
it
that
good?
The natural world
Isn't
is wonderful. And things like
breathing
music and art.
And listening.
And learning things.
Looking, going for
and
walks,
meeting new people and travelling.
Puppy
and
dogs,
going to new places.
Ice
oh,
cream.
Lovely. Yes, I'm not too keen on the ice cream, but a good red. Yes, I'm all in favour of that.
That was the wonderful Sister Veronica Brady, a chat we had in 1996. Let me remind you, Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Western Australia, a nun, and a self-confessed ratbag. Her books include The Future People, The Mystics, A Crucible of Prophets, Can These Bones Live?, and South of My Days, her biography of Judith Wright. That's it from this week's classic. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news, and we will, with God's blessing. And I'm sure Veronica can fix that for us. See you later.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.